gentleman. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick.
I'm Julia Minton.
And Julia, why don't you start us off by telling folks how they can get in touch with us and pop up our previously archived versions and that kind of show business stuff.
Bob and I are real people, and we love to hear from our listening audience. And in fact, many of our show topics have come from you and your suggestions. So we really do like hearing from you. Thinking Clearly, we have a Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio. Just punch on Facebook, you'll find it. We have an email address, tc@kmud.org. That's TC like Thinking Clearly.
Yes.
And then my favorite, you can listen to Bob and me on demand with your podcast app. Just open up your podcast app, go to where you add feeds, they're all a little different, and you just search Thinking Clearly. We should be there. Or you can visit thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
You could go on a Thinking Clearly binge and listen to all 42 episodes, you know. Binge listen.
That's how it cured my insomnia.
Well, I've got a quote that's related to the topic for this episode of Thinking Clearly, and it goes like this. Quote, "This book is about belief. It's a book about truth and knowledge, science and evidence, but most of all, it's a book about false beliefs. How do we form beliefs, especially false ones? How do they persist, and why do they spread?" And that's a quote from the introduction to the book, which is co-authored by our guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly. So why don't you frame the topic tonight?
Yeah, tonight we're going to be talking about truth, knowledge and evidence, how we form beliefs, especially false ones, how those beliefs persist and spread, the importance of evidence-based policy, something we talk about quite a bit, and the dangers of disinformation and misinformation in a democratic society.
So stay tuned, because our guest is Professor Kaylin O'Connor from the Department of Logic and Philosophy of Science at UC Irvine. And her specialties include the philosophy of biology and behavioral sciences, philosophy of science and evolutionary game theory. And she's a member of the Institute for Mathematical Behavioral Science at University of California at Irvine. In addition, she's got numerous published articles, and she has two books out this year, The Origins of Unfairness and the one that we're going to be focusing on in this episode of Thinking Clearly, with the title of The Misinformation Age, How False Beliefs Spread. Kaylin, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's get started here. The quote I read in the introduction here, when we opened the show, is from the introduction in your book, The Misinformation Age. And it refers to the importance of understanding how false beliefs are formed and how they persist and how they spread. So give us a take on why those topics are important to get a handle on.
Well, so there are a lot of reasons to care about the spread of false beliefs, but I think the most important reason is a really pragmatic one. That as humans, when we make choices and decisions about how to act in the world, our beliefs really matter to those choices. So if I believe that a snake is poisonous, I won't pick it up. But if I believe that it's not poisonous, maybe I would be more willing to get close to it. Our beliefs matter to what we do, and what we do matters to us, to our payoffs in the world, to what happens to us. So understanding our false beliefs is really important for understanding how we act in our own best interests.
Julia and I have talked about this a lot on this show, but how we're really constantly being manipulated. There's misinformation, there's spin out there, disinformation, and we seem to be living in an era where there's much more contrived, purposeful disinformation than I ever remember. There's been spin forever. I think the internet has greatly increased that too, because it's increased our connectedness. But we'll get into some of that.
You know, I just have to preface with you had an article in Scientific American in September, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to admit, it has been a pretty long time since I picked up a Scientific American. And Bob and I saw separately on completely different weeks.
Yeah.
saw the cover and were like, oh, this is something we should pick up and talk about.
I get it every edition. I wait at the mailbox for it to come.
It must have been our connection.
I guess.
Yeah. So in that Scientific American article that you wrote and in your book, give us an overview of the kind of issues you've been exploring and the tools you use to do that.
So what we've really been interested in is the social spread of information. So we've seen a lot of analyses of people's false beliefs and the prevalence of false beliefs in our society that have looked at how humans are individually bad at reasoning. So things like people are really bad at dealing with probabilities, or people have biases that confirm their current beliefs. But we thought that while those things are really important to understand, what's maybe more important to understand is the ways in which people are social learners. So our book, The Misinformation Age, really focuses on that. How do people develop beliefs? By picking up ideas, beliefs, knowledge from those in their social networks, from those in their communities. And this is something that we all do, and we think it's really the more important process to understand when it comes to understanding why people hold the beliefs they do.
You're in the Department of Philosophy, right?
Yeah, so I'm in a department called Logic and Philosophy of Science. It's an interdisciplinary department, but what we mostly do is philosophy as it connects to different scientific disciplines. So philosophy as it connects to biology, or as it connects to economics or to physics. So a kind of philosophy plus other sciences department.
What I was getting at here is that, and we've talked a little bit about this on the show, but most people's idea of somebody that considers themselves a philosopher by training and is academically working in philosophy, or even an interdisciplinary program, think that philosophers think about things very, very deeply. They may write about those things, they may have discussions about those things, but they don't think of them as actually doing research and going out and tracking something in a almost experimental way. But you actually have approached this idea not just by thinking about it, but actually doing something. Can you frame that for our audience a little bit?
Yeah, so we use some particular methodologies for trying to understand how false beliefs spread in societies. So one thing we do is look at the history of science and use different case studies to look at how scientists, who are some of, you know, the best learners in our society, might nonetheless sometimes have false beliefs. And then another thing that we do in this book is to use models to understand the spread of false belief. And by models, well, I don't mean, you know, Christy Turlington. I mean computer simulations, where we create some representation of a real society and look at what happens in that representation and then try to use that to understand how false beliefs spread in the real world.
I'd like to get into that a little bit more. We have some questions later on that'll get into some of the details about that. So let's talk about that a little bit. We're talking about programming a computer to do a simulation of some sort of human behavior, right?
That's right. So we create models, and what a model is meant to be is some kind of structure that's similar to the real world in some way, but that's easier to study. And so you create a computer simulation where you have agents who act like humans in some ways, and then you can study what happens in this simulated society and then try to find out about the real world by studying the simulation.
And you're studying like social interaction, how things are spread socially, how information is spread socially. That's pretty much what the article was talking about. Is that correct?
Right. So we try to study how people share ideas with each other, how they share knowledge, how they share evidence, and how the sharing of this evidence might lead to different beliefs in different people.
So you start out, just to give the audience a picture of this, you start out with a pretty simplified model, right? You can't model all of the complexity of human behavior and social interaction, right? So you start out with a very simplified set of parameters that you write a computer program around.
That's right. So when people use models to understand human behavior, the models almost always have to simplify from what happens with real humans, because real humans are extremely complicated creatures. There are all sorts of things that go into how we learn, how we form beliefs, how we choose actions, et cetera, et cetera. So we look at kind of what you might imagine is some sort of simplified agent or simplified representation of a person. But actually, when we look at these simplified models, there are some ways in which they give us knowledge that we couldn't get otherwise. So, for example, in the misinformation age, we describe models where we look at conformity, so the tendency of humans to act like other people around them, to imitate those in their social networks, to try not to stick out, to try not to do things that others around them might disapprove of. And having these models allows us to ask, okay, what would happen if we could completely remove conformist bias and the urge to conform from humans, which is something that we can't do with real humans. We are too complicated. We can't take away our actual psychological urges. But in a model, we can remove that feature and see what happens, or include that feature and see what happens, and ask, well, does conformity help us form good beliefs, or does it actually hurt our beliefs?
Basically, there's some trade-offs then. You can't model the complexity of social human behavior, but you can completely control the variables, and there's no ethical requirements for your subjects. So we're looking at some trade-offs, right?
I think that's right. So models can be really useful for answering certain kinds of questions. They can't answer every kind of question because models of people are not the same as real people. But they do allow us to change things about idealized people that we couldn't change in the real world. And as you point out, they allow us to do experiments which don't have any ethical consequences. Mm-hmm. So we can test the beliefs of idealized representations of people without actually harming anyone in the real world.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you about and get into a little bit is that we've talked a lot on this show about individual human biases, heuristics, and biases like confirmation biases. And this is really a look at the individual and the vulnerabilities that we have in our thought processes and our cognitions. But you're really making a case in your book that it's important to look at the sociology and the social interaction between people. And I have a quote here. It says that we are social learners and, quote, develop most of our beliefs from the trusted testimony of others, such as teachers, parents, and friends. So you link that social learning focus to our modern technologies like social media. Bring these ideas out a little bit about why it's so important to, rather than just look individually at biases and things like that, to look at the social interaction and that dynamic way that information is spread.
Right. So once we think about humans as being real social learners, there are a whole set of factors that we need to understand in thinking about why people hold the beliefs that we do. So things like, who do we trust and why do we trust them? Who in our social networks are actively trying to mislead us? How do these propagandists take advantage of our social nature in trying to mislead us? Once we start asking these kinds of questions, we get a deeper understanding of human belief, but we also get a lot of insight into what is happening on social media today. So a naive view of what would happen when we first started having the internet would be something like, well, no one's ever going to believe anything false again, because now we have this wonderful resource that will allow us to answer basically any question that we might ask with all the knowledge available to humans. It's just right at our fingertips. That hasn't really turned out. In fact, we might think paradoxically, social media seems to have in some ways precipitated a crisis in false belief. But when we think of ourselves as social knowers, that actually makes a lot of sense. Social media has allowed us to connect with different people than we might have connected with if we didn't have the internet. It has allowed a lot of people to gain access to us who wouldn't have had access otherwise. So, for example, the Internet Research Agency. This is the Russian propaganda group that works through social media. Now, because of social media, can pose as peers, friends, confidants, the sort of people we might trust and spread misinformation to us. And because we are social knowers who tend to trust things that others tell us, especially people who look like the kind of people we might trust, we're vulnerable to that kind of misinformation.
Yeah. And of course, confirmation bias, if it has a hint of something that I already believe, you want to grab onto it that much more.
Yeah. So our biases as individual reasoners combined with our biases as social knowers. So confirmation bias is the bias whereby we tend to trust evidence that fits with the things we already believe. So the reasoning bias that we all engage in as individuals, when we're connected to others, we might tend to choose people who give us information that fits with what we already believe as good sources of knowledge.
And so it seems we've, you know, talking about the computer models, that you've, to understand the details of how our networks might shape and be used to communicate beliefs, you've built these computer models and you run a simulation to examine the outcomes. Is that kind of a good description?
Yeah, that's right.
And so in your writing, you are able to explain with diagrams. The Scientific American has really very kind of interesting diagrams. Unfortunately, this is radio. And like I say, radio math, and I'm going to add diagrams don't work super well on the radio. So could you give us sort of a taste of what the visual would look like for our listeners?
Okay, so a picture is worth a thousand words. Get ready for a thousand words, folks. So we build models that are sometimes called network models. And network models, their basic aspects are these. So there are nodes in the network. And nodes would be individuals, actors, basically representations of people that can learn things, that have certain beliefs, that have certain goals. And then in between these nodes are edges or connections. So if you imagine the nodes as little points in space, the edges are lines between them. And these are meant to represent some kind of social tie. So an edge could mean that this is a friend of yours or someone you regularly interact with or someone you regularly share knowledge with. And then in these models, we use this kind of network as a representation of real people and their real social ties, where we suppose that these social ties track who is able to share information with each other. So who gives evidence to which other people and who learns from whom.
Mm-hmm. So I would be a node and Bob would be a node, and the line between us might be the show.
Sure, your interactions where you share knowledge and information with each other.
And I notice in the article and in your book, there's a couple other terms that, and I think they're synonymous with node, agent, mm-hmm. and scientist. And I suspect a scientist is a certain kind of node that has been programmed to have some characteristics or some behavioral behavior. Is that correct?
So I'm a philosopher of science, which means that a lot of my work has involved studying how scientific communities work. And in fact, before I wrote this book on misinformation generally, I was doing a lot of modeling work to look at scientific communities. So how do scientists share information with each other? How do ideas spread in science? Why, in some cases, do scientists continue to believe false things instead of true things? So scientists in our models are meant to correspond to individuals who are trying to get evidence from the world and use that evidence to develop good beliefs about the world. Agents is a really general modeling term to refer to actors who have some sort of goals and are acting to fulfill those goals. So in general, we use the term agents to be a kind of representation of real people who have some goal that they're trying to meet, even though the agents in our models don't correspond to all the psychological or social complexity of real human beings.
But the term node agent and scientist are all meaning the things that are connected by edges, the things that are giving and receiving communication in your model. Is that right?
In our particular models,
yeah.
That's right.
And you're saying that when you program these agents to be scientists, then you're giving them certain behaviors, right? Essentially akin to a behavior.
Yeah. So we use these models to represent, for example, how scientists might share information. And in creating these models, we give the agents different possibilities for behavior that are meant to at least approximately track what different scientists could do.
I've read the book, and so I have an idea of this, but I'm wondering whether our listening audience does at this point. So you actually program the various agents or scientists in a fashion that determines how they change their belief or how they communicate their beliefs. Is that right?
We do. So, I mean, we have different models, some of which we have agents or individuals who are meant to represent scientists. Sometimes they're meant to represent just anyone who is trying to learn things about the world. And in these different models, we, you know, make assumptions about how people do this. So one thing people tend to do is to observe evidence and then change their beliefs on the basis of that evidence. So if I learn that 20 people who smoked got cancer, whereas people who didn't smoke didn't tend to get cancer, I might change my beliefs on the basis of that. So in our models, we have both scientists and representations of non-scientists who can learn on the basis of evidence that they observe.
The general idea is that you're able to control the programming, and that controls the flow of information, and a belief is able to be changed from one belief to another. Is that right? And that will play out in the model as you run it?
So a model individuals who can gather some kind of evidence about the world. So, for example, who might be able to run some sort of test or experiment, and then who have beliefs about what's true, and those beliefs can change on the basis of what they observe and what other individuals in their social network observe.
So I want to remind listeners that you are tuned to Thinking Clearly on KMUD, where we're discussing how false beliefs form spread through social networks with philosophy professor Kaylin O'Connor from UC Irvine. What are some of your findings? Now, we've gotten into kind of the big picture of what you're doing. What are some of your findings that are relevant to understanding how these social networks come into play here?
So we use our models to ask, under different scenarios, when are communities more or less likely to hold true beliefs? So one thing we look at is conformity bias. So do our agents try to conform to each other by saying or doing the same thing as those who they have social connections with? And we find that conformity bias makes communities less good at developing true beliefs, for the reason that when people try to conform to each other, they don't necessarily pass on good information. So if I'm trying to do the same thing as those in my community, if I learn something that goes against their beliefs, I might not be willing to share that with other people. We also look at the ways that people trust each other. So one thing that real people tend to do is to place more trust in those who share beliefs with them. So for example, if I believe that GMO crops are dangerous, which by the way, there isn't much evidence that they are, but if I believe that, I might trust someone who shares my belief more than I trust someone who doesn't. So we ask, mm-hmm. for example, when people have this kind of social trust, how does that shape whether they're good at developing good beliefs or not? And we find that that kind of social trust that's based on shared beliefs can lead to polarization. So communities of people who have differing beliefs that conflict with each other, and that over time, even with discussion, they don't come to shared belief.
Yeah, let's. I want to dig into that polarization. It's a topic that Bob and I have discussed a number of times, mostly the negative effects of polarization. Basically, what has your research shown or help us understand about polarization among people?
So we've researched how polarization can happen. And one thing we found is that there actually can be multiple causes for polarization. So one cause can be that people are in different areas of a social network. And that means that they're listening to information coming from really different sources. And when you're listening to different sources and you get different information, then you can end up with different beliefs from other people in your social network. Another thing that can cause polarization is when people just only trust the people who share beliefs with them. So if you're an anti-vaccine advocate, if you only trust other anti-vaccine advocates, whereas if you believe vaccines work, which they do and they're not dangerous, and you only trust people who share your beliefs, you can end up with polarization because people are only trusting the evidence and claims from those who already believe the same things as them. A third thing that we find can cause polarization is conformity, which is something I've been bringing up. So say you want to be like or act like those who are within your area of a social network, but there might be other areas of a social network where people are trying to conform with each other. If you have a situation like that, you can have stable beliefs that are polarized, where because you're each trying to fit with what the people around you do, you never change beliefs, even though there might be good evidence to prompt you to do so.
I think what's interesting is that you're able to actually program these relatively simple computer models, and it corresponds to what psychologists are in the lab studying and are finding out. For example, that idea that we tend to trust the beliefs of people who believe like us, that kind of relates to research that have been done by a number of people, including Dan Kahan. We had a program on identity protective cognition. So it reminds me of that. And that's pretty amazing to be able to program a computer and you find through your simulation, let that computer play out and it echoes some of the things that are actually being found out and verified and supported by experimental research in psychology and cognitive science.
Yeah. I mean, computers can do that. Amazing.
That's pretty amazing. Talk about some of the possible implications of your findings. We're a show about critical thinking, and we're all about truth-seeking on this show. So talk a little bit about possible implications of your findings that might be used to actually facilitate truth-seeking, not just agreeing with those that have similar beliefs to us, but actual seeking of the truth.
Okay, so maybe a bit of a discussion of practical things that people can do to try to have more accurate or true beliefs themselves? Is that the...
Well, what has come out of your research that could relate to, rather than just letting social media and that kind of thing play out as it has been, which is people sending and forwarding posts that sometimes they haven't even read, rather than
most of the time haven't read,
rather than let that happen. What kind of findings have come out of your research that you would be able to say this would allow people to engage in actually coming to the truth rather than just speaking to the choir?
Yeah. So there are a bunch of things that are relevant here. So one thing that we haven't talked about a lot about so far is the role of various propagandists or people who are promoting misinformation and disinformation online in shaping our beliefs. So one key goal of people who are getting information from social media is to try to avoid those who have nefarious goals but are trying to control our beliefs. And there are a lot of people like that. I mean, surprisingly many. Different political groups, different industrial groups, people from foreign governments, people from political organizations within our own countries. So a lot of the goal has to be to try to avoid this kind of misinformation, which can be really tricky. One thing I recommend to people is that they should look at the source, not the sharer. So if you do empirical work on what kind of information people tend to trust online, well, people tend to trust things that are shared by people they trust. So if there's someone who you have a good opinion of, who has a good reputation, who's a lot like you, you tend to trust the things they share. But what makes more sense and will be better at promoting true beliefs is to look at where the information comes from. So someone who's a lot like you might share things that are false. But if you look at news sources that tend to have a really good track record, like, say, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and not only do they have a good track record, but they have a strong incentive to publish things that are true, looking at these kind of sources is going to generally be a good bet to forming true beliefs for yourself, rather than just being willing to uptake whatever information comes from people you like and trust.
Sorry, I got deep into that thought. and you gave great examples as well in your article of sort of how these have played out, in fact, in our history. Are there any that might be your favorite that you'd like to share with us so we kind of understand what that might look like?
Sorry. So my favorite, which?
Examples of what that has looked like historically. Of like disinformation.
Okay, examples of disinformation historically. Well, so it depends how deep in history you want to go. So if you look back at the history of belief, especially about scientific matters of fact, there are false beliefs going back as far as you would like. So one thing we document in our book and use as an example is this belief in medieval Europe, which was that somewhere in India, there were these organisms called the vegetable lamb of Tartary that were plants that had pods in which grew a literal tiny living lamb. Now, of course, this creature never existed, right. But people for 400 years in Europe spread this idea from person to person that this was a real living thing that maybe you could find somewhere in India. Now, more recently, there has been a lot of misinformation and disinformation online. And some of this seems to have started from, you know, kind of random individual sources. So if you look at Pizzagate, a bunch of people on kind of far-right websites like 4chan and certain areas of Reddit started developing this conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was running a child prostitution ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. called Comic Ping Pong. And this idea kind of spread from person to person, and eventually it led someone to go to Comic Ping Pong with a gun to try to save these children, which of course did not actually exist. So I take that to be a really good example of a more modern case of false belief.
No, thank you.
On the basis of
Those are both great examples, because the examples you're given have no evidence. No evidence was presented. There's maybe speculation, and yet that idea continued to proliferate.
I want to say that one of the things I really loved about your book is that you bring up those examples and you treat those examples in journalistic detail. and a person feels like they were there. You're telling the story, but you're getting enough facts and information in there that I thought I was reading a news article about it. And then you use those later on in describing the more abstract ideas that you are trying to present, and you anchor them to those examples. I really love that about your book.
Well, we do try to use case studies to help give everyone a grip on how different processes work, whereby misinformation is spread, because we think that's it basically helps us all understand better what's happening in these different processes.
Yeah. And thanks, Bob was a bit more eloquent than I was, but I appreciate that. So in these models, you know, they are computer simulated models. What are the assumptions and the limitation of that type of research?
Well, we look at a number of different models in the book, and of course, they all have slightly different assumptions and slightly different limitations. So one thing that people often think is a limitation of this kind of model is that, of course, we create, as we've been talking about, we create representations of humans and human learners, but they're never going to be as complicated. They're never going to be as cognitively complex as real humans are. So the way real humans learn things and form beliefs is really complicated. It's dependent on all sorts of reasoning biases, but also different good reasoning abilities. It's dependent on a lot of social biases. So a limitation of the models is that the way we represent humans is never going to be fully accurate to the real world. Now, that is a limitation. But in some ways, it's also a strength of these kinds of models, because in these sorts of models, what you can do is isolate particular factors of human reasoning and learning and see what happens when you turn these factors on and off, when you intervene on them. So you can say, let's suppose we had humans who only trust other individuals who share their same beliefs. So that's a thing that we know humans do. So let's suppose we have a model where our agents really do that. And we can see, are these agents good at learning the truth based on evidence? Are they bad at it? And then we can turn that off. Say, suppose we have humans who don't care what other individuals believe. They trust others equally, even if they're individuals who don't believe the same thing as me. And we can see, are these individuals better or worse at learning real facts than the ones who have more realistic human biases? So the simplicity of the model is in some ways a limitation, but in some ways a strength. The fact that these models are so simple allows us to kind of isolate particular factors regarding how humans learn and see, well, how do these factors all on their own influence the success of our learning and of our belief development?
One of the things, Julia and I were talking about this before the show, is how we live in such an interesting time in that we have sociology, we have social psychology, we have cognitive science, we have economics.
Behavioral economics.
Behavioral economics, anthropology. We have these different...
Did you say philosophy? No.
Well, philosophy. I'm saving philosophy for last.
Okay. Oh,
because the point I'm trying to get at here is that they're looking at some of the same questions, but from their own perspective, and we're getting kind of what E.O. Wilson called a consilience happening, I think, where we're getting different fields who are beginning to merge in terms of being cooperative with each other so that they can come to common agreement about terms and begin to get the big picture, not just from their own discipline. And what I like about what you're doing is that you're using philosophy, which is the systematic way of thinking about thinking and how people will actually come to beliefs and how do we form our beliefs? Where do we get our knowledge of what is truth from? How do we reason through things? And is the discipline that studies that, and you're combining that with computer science and coming up with some aspects that could shed light on human behavior. So what I'm wondering is there stuff that is coming out of your research that you could pass on to the psych department and, you know, have a cooperative working relationship with them and say, I want you to look at what I've found in the computer modeling and how does that relate to something that you might actually bring some subjects into the lab to verify experimentally. Does that happen, or have you thought about that?
Yeah, it absolutely does. So the work that I do, so I'm a philosopher, but the work that I do is highly interdisciplinary. So I've published in sociology, mathematical sociology. I've published actually in robotics and AI. I work all the time with economists and with biologists, and my work is quite relevant to psychologists. So actually tomorrow I'll be at a conference where I'm speaking with psychologists and philosophers and people from lots of different disciplines. This is actually something that's it's kind of nice about working on this area of misinformation, disinformation, false belief, is that it's a topic that's of a lot of interest to a lot of people. And it turns out people from many different disciplines have come together to research this. And their research has really been synergistic. So people are bringing lots of different approaches, lots of different scientific methodologies to research this. I think that's great. As a philosopher, so sometimes people will ask me, is what you're doing really philosophy? I mean, you're doing computer modeling. I also do human subjects research. I use a lot of tools from economics and biology, like game theory and evolutionary modeling. Is this philosophy? I like to take a really old school view. So philosophy used to be just the study of what's true. There used to be natural philosophy, which was basically the sciences, and moralistic philosophy. And when people ask me, is this philosophy, I want to say something like, well, I'm trying to figure out things about how the world, how the works, how people work. I don't see why, as a philosopher, I ought to avoid the best methods for figuring that out that have been developed in the sciences. Why would I tie one hand behind my back in trying to figure out, you know, how people work or what's true or how false beliefs spread?
I love that. And while we're waiting for some calls, I have another question. Would it be possible to model more complex scientists, one who uses critical thinking to evaluate beliefs, but then doesn't pass that belief along unless it passes the critical thinking test?
Sure. So there are many different kinds of models of humans and human society, and they are on different levels of complexity. So some models of humans will model human reasoning as quite basic and low rationality. Others will model humans as very high rationality. Others somewhere in between, what is sometimes called bounded rationality in the modeling community. All these different kinds of models, they're not perfect, but they're appropriate to different kinds of questions and investigations we're doing. So in some cases, a low rationality model of humans will actually give us quite a lot of insight into how humans work and behave. In other cases, you want a higher rationality model, and that will give us more insight into why humans are doing the things they're doing. It's quite dependent on what sort of research question you're asking and what you're trying to figure out about people.
Yeah. So you start with the simpler models and then build from there. And I think we do have some callers, so let's take the first call. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Pizzagate, and I had the same reaction to the whole thing, like, what? You know, talk about fake news. And then along comes Jeffrey Epstein, and I went, what? How do you reconcile that? So that makes you think Pizzagate had some reality. What do you think?
Well, how does that relate to the topic, which is the, because we're really not talking about Pizzagate, that's just an example that was used. How does that relate to how information is spread socially through social media? How do you come to your beliefs and information through communicating with other people? That's the topic.
I'm doing that. I'm communicating with you, and I'm trying to reconcile the ability to understand what you're talking about in relation to misinformation getting spread.
Okay.
And so the misinformation of Pizzagate was like crazy, you know, like really, you know, pedophilia. And then Bill Clinton is implicated in the Jeffrey Epstein thing. I just, I'm confused. If you could help me, I'll take my answer. I don't want to bore anybody. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Caitlin, do you have a response to that?
I'm wondering, is this Sorry, is this about the conspiracy theory that Jeffrey Epstein was murdered in jail, or?
I think we could kind of frame it as how this information gets. The interesting part in terms of relating to the topic is how this kind of information spreads.
The information about
conspiracy, you know, theories about people doing things that are really out there, like that, like the Pizzagate idea. In other words, we could use that as an example, the Pizzagate or any other thing as an example as to where that started, how it spread through the social networks.
Well, I guess I think as far as, you know, Pizzagate goes, the most one of the most important things to think about is how humans are social learners and tend to spread beliefs from person to person. So Pizzagate is an example of a really absurd belief. There was no evidence that Hillary Clinton was running a child prostitution ring out of a pizza parlor. That idea isn't something that people would ever arrive at individually, mm-hmm. but the fact that they could learn from each other socially meant that many people developed this same belief because they heard it from other people online. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what the caller, what thing about Jeffrey Epstein the caller was referring to, but, you know, there is a conspiracy theory that Jeffrey Epstein was killed by some political actor rather than committing suicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, the evidence seems to suggest that he in fact committed suicide, but this conspiracy theory is again spreading almost like a virus might spread from person to person. You know, someone develops that theory, shares it with another person, they share it with another friend in the same way that Pizzagate spread in that way.
And it kind of reinforces what you found in your research, is that we tend to believe the things that people who have similar beliefs to us believe.
Yeah, in general, you might say that across domains, humans are actually pretty trusting of each other. We tend to believe most of the things that other people tell us most of the time.
Mm-hmm. I think we have another caller.
So let's take the next caller.
Hi. Great show tonight.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Over the years, I've been studying what I consider one of the most mysterious mysteries of our times, whether people who claim they've been abducted by extraterrestrials or interdimensional beings are telling the truth, or are they just dreaming or having an hallucinatory experience. And it turns out that a lot of these people around the world independently describe the same event scenarios, even though a good number of them are not the least bit interested in the phenomena. And at the same time, again, many people who are highly religious, people of faith, so to speak, have total faith in their belief system, which doesn't mean that the belief system is true. They just have absolute faith that it's true. And the funny part is that many of these religious people will reject people who claim to have had have been abducted by extraterrestrials or interdimensional beings, and they'll even call it a demonic experience instead of accepting the story as it is.
And how does these beliefs, in your opinion and your experience, how do these beliefs get perpetuated from person to person?
Well, my belief is that I have a tendency to believe a person who claims these claims. You know, they're most probably, a lot of these people are just absolutely normal people in every way. They hold a job, family people, they're everything, but they have one, what we would call a crazy story about some phenomena that happened to them. And this is like thousands of people around the world. You can go to YouTube and watch these people talk about their abductions. They're very normal in every way. In fact, they don't want to be associated with it. It's like a stamp saying that you're crazy, and they shy away from it. They lose their families, they lose their kids, they lose their job, and yet it happened to them. They have to talk about it. So that's the mystery. Is it true? Is it not true? What's it all about?
We're not really, and we're not really here to debate the truth or untruth of any of these particular theories or ideas. We're here to examine how beliefs are spread and how they're perpetuated. So you brought up one thing. YouTube is one thing, that a treasure trove of various ideas that people are attracted to, and they go purposely looking for YouTube video or presentation on a particular thing that they tend to believe anyway, and that kind of reinforces the belief.
So you deny it then? You're saying
We're not here to debate it, to deny it, or to even examine the truth of it. We're here to examine the process. Uh-huh. See, that's what this show is about that sometimes people don't understand, is that we will bring up and mention particular situations because we have to anchor them to something that's concrete. We can't talk in the abstract all the time. Yeah. When we do that, sometimes it triggers people to that have strong feelings about those beliefs to call the show and talk about the belief and try to promote the belief. But we're not really here to do that. We're here to do something that's, I think, much more important, which is to examine the process of how we come to these beliefs and how we communicate with each other about our beliefs, how we examine the beliefs, how we look for the evidence behind the beliefs, and how we use our thought processes to think that through. And that's what this show is about. It's not about whether there was a Pizzagate conspiracy or whether there are alien abductions. We appreciate it when people call, but we try to shift people's thinking to the process rather than the examples that we use.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and you brought up an interesting example about YouTube. This isn't necessarily the spread of ideas between people, but that you can watch a YouTube video and YouTube itself would suggest similar videos that go into yet more detail.
Yes.
Kind of entrenching that belief.
Yeah, yeah.
And I imagine something like that, it's very similar between people if that belief is encouraged and dug into between folks. It becomes more concrete, I would think.
Yeah. Kaylin, do you have a comment about that?
Well, yeah. So a lot of people have written about how the structure of social media means that we can control who we tend to interact with. We can pick which people are in our communities. And this means that when we have biases towards conformity and when we're looking to trust people who share our beliefs, we can pick just those people who have our same beliefs to conform with and just those same people to trust. And that can create situations where groups of people can really have beliefs that aren't well supported by evidence, that aren't accurate beliefs, and yet they can create social structures that support those beliefs nonetheless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good description.
And I'm hesitant to say the word Pizzagate again, but it does.
I'm getting hungry.
It does have a relevance to to my last question here, because you've written about the importance of evidence-based policy and the dangers of disinformation and misinformation in a democratic society. And Pizzagate was certainly politicized. Can you explain your views in that regard in just a couple minutes, because we're pretty close to the top of the hour?
Yeah, so why do we even want to have accurate or true beliefs? The answer is something like our beliefs shape what we do. They shape the choices that we make. And if we want to behave in ways that respect our values, that get us the things that we want in the world, we need beliefs that allow us to do that. And that's true for individuals, but it's also true for democracies and groups of people who are making joint beliefs. So if you have a democracy where, say, most people want to have a society that's sustainable, that's productive, that will be able to support, you know, basically good well-being for our children and grandchildren, we need to have beliefs about which of our actions are going to be sustainable actions and productive actions and ones that will allow for a good, healthy earth for our children to live in. And so these are some of the really core reasons why we want to have good beliefs. Mm-hmm. And when we have bad beliefs, they prevent us, say, from preventing climate change, which is an enormous threat to human well-being and public health, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a great deal of sense.
Not just humans, yeah.
And it's well
not
said.
Not just humans, right.
And it's well said. And we will post on our Facebook page information where folks can go to see your work and your research and your book and that sort of thing. So Professor Kaylin O'Connor from UCI, I want to thank you very much for being our guest on Thinking Clearly.
Well, it was really my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And I want to thank our engineer, Mitch, and as always, Julia. And I want to thank our masterful engineer and program director, Nate Horning. And Julia?
Thank you, Bob.
What do you think we ought to say? I think we ought to say, and until next time, keep thinking
clearly. Order a pizza?
Good night.
Keep thinking clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.